child, strangled and buried on Chiswell's land. Took him home with the idea of getting him to hospital, but he asked Geraint Wynne's advice first. Wynne was furious, told him on no account to call an ambulance.
"Did he know?" said Strike, frowning.
From what Malik's told us, Wynne was worried association with Billy's story would taint his own credibility. He didn't want the waters muddied by a psychotic tramp. Blew up at Malik for taking him into a house belonging to the Wynnes. Told him to turf him out on the street again. Trouble was,
Billy wouldn't go, said Strike.
Exactly. Malik says he was clearly out of his mind. Thought he was being held against his will. Curled up in the bathroom most of the time. Anyway, Leybourne took a deep breath. Malik's had enough of covering up for the Wynnes. He's confirmed that Wynne wasn't with him on the morning of Chiswell's death. Wynne told Malik afterwards, when he put pressure on Malik to lie, he'd had an urgent phone call at 6 a.m. that day, which is why he left the marital home early.
And you've traced that call, said Strike.
Leybourne picked up the printout of phone records, rifled through them, then handed a couple of marked pages to Strike. Here you go, burner phones, he said. We've got 3 different numbers so far. There were probably more. Used once, never used again. Untraceable except for the single instance we got on record. Munson the planning. A single use phone was used to contact Wynne that morning, and 2 more were used to call Kinvara Chiswell on separate occasions during the previous weeks. She can't remember who called her, but both times, see there, she talked to whoever it was for over an hour.
"What's Wynne got to say for himself?" asked Strike.
"Closed up like an oyster," said Leybourne. "We're working on him, don't worry. There are porn stars who've been fucked fewer different ways than Geraint W. Sorry, love," he said, grinning to Robin, who found the apology more offensive than anything Leybourne had said. "But you take my point. He might as well tell us everything now. He's screwed every which "Well," he said, floundering once more. "What interests me," he started up again, "is how much the wife knew. Strange woman."
"In what way?"
asked Robin.
"Oh, you know, I think she plays on this a bit," said Leybourne, with a vague gesture towards his eyes. "Very hard to believe she didn't know what he was up to."
"Speaking of people not knowing what their other halves are up to," interposed Strike, who thought he detected a martial glint in Robin's eye, "how's it going with our friend Flick?"
"Ah, we're making very good progress there," said Leybourne. "The parents have been helpful in her case. They're both lawyers and they've been urging her to cooperate. She's admitted she was Chiswell's cleaner, that she stole the note and took receipt of the crate of champagne right before Chiswell told her he couldn't afford her any more. Says she put it in a cupboard in the kitchen."
"Who delivered it?"
"She can't remember."
"We'll find out. Courier service, I shouldn't wonder, booked on another burner phone."
"And the credit card?"
"That was another good spot of yours," admitted Leybourne. "We didn't know a credit card had gone missing. We got details through from the bank this morning. The same day Flick's flatmate realised the card was gone, somebody charged a crate of champagne and bought 100 quid's worth of stuff on Amazon, all to be sent to an address in Maidavale. Nobody took delivery, so it was returned to the depot, where it was picked up that afternoon by someone who had the failed delivery notice. We're trying to locate the staff who can identify the person who collected it, and we're getting a breakdown on what was bought on Amazon. But my money's on helium, tubing, and latex gloves." This was all planned months in advance. Months.
"And that?" Strike asked,
pointing to the photocopy of the note in Chisel's handwriting, which was lying on the side in its polythene bag.
"Has she told you why she nicked it yet?"
"She says she saw a bill and thought it meant her boyfriend's brother."
"Ironic, really," said Leybourne.
"If she hadn't stolen it, we wouldn't have cottoned on nearly so fast, would we?" The "we," thought Robin, was daring, because it had been Strike who had cottoned on. Strike who had finally cracked the significance of Chisel's note as they drove back to London from Chisel House.
"Robin deserves the bulk of the credit there, too," said Strike. "She found the thing. She noticed Blanc de Blanc and the Grand Vitara.
I just pieced it together once it was staring me in the face. "Well, we were just behind you," said Leybourne, absent-mindedly scratching his belly. "I'm sure we'd have got there."
Robin's mobile vibrated in her pocket again. Somebody was calling this time.
"I need to take this. Is there anywhere I can..."
"Through here," said Leybourne helpfully, opening a side door. It was a photocopier room, with a small window covered in a Venetian blind. Robin closed the door on the other's conversation and answered,
"Hi, Sarah."
"Hi,"
said Sarah Shadlock. She sounded totally unlike the Sarah whom Robin had known for nearly 9 years, the confident and bombastic blonde whom Robin had sensed, even in their teens, was hoping that some mischance might befall Matthew's long-distance relationship with his girlfriend. Always there through the years, giggling at Matthew's jokes, touching his arm, asking loaded questions about Robin's relationship with Strike, Sarah had dated other men, settling at last for poor, tedious Tom, with his well-paid job and his bald patch, who would put diamonds on Sarah's finger and in her ears, but never quelled her yen for Matthew Cunliffe. All her swagger had gone today.
"Well, I've asked two experts, but..." she said, sounding fragile and fearful. "And they can't say for sure, not from the photograph taken on a phone."
"Well, obviously not," said Robin coolly. "I said in my text, didn't I, that I wasn't expecting a definitive answer. We're not asking for a firm identification or valuation. All we want to know is whether somebody might have credibly believed..."
"Well, then, yes," said Sarah. "One of our experts is quite excited about it, actually. One of the old notebooks lists a painting done of a mare with a dead foal, but it's never been found."
"What notebooks?"
"Oh, sorry," said Sarah.
She had never sounded so meek, so frightened in Robin's vicinity.
"Stubbs."
"And if it is a Stubbs?" asked Robin, turning to look out of the window at the Feathers, a pub where she and Strike had sometimes drunk.
"Well, this is entirely speculative, obviously. But if it's genuine, if it's the one he listed in 1760, it could be a lot."
"Give me a rough estimate."
"Well, his gimcrack went for..."
$22 million, said Robin, feeling suddenly light-headed.
"Yes. You said so at our housewarming party."
Sarah made no answer. Perhaps the mention of the party, where she had brought lilies to her lover's wife's house, had scared her.
"So if Mare Mourning is a genuine Stubbs, it'd probably make more than gimcrack at auction. It's a unique subject. Stubbs was an anatomist, as much scientist as artist. If this is a depiction of a lethal white foal, it might be the first recorded instance. It could set records."
Robin's mobile buzzed in her hand. Another text had arrived.
"This has been very helpful, Sarah, thanks. You'll keep this confidential?"
"Yes, of course," said Sarah.
And then in a rush, "Robin, listen, no," said Robin, trying to stay calm. "I'm working a case."
"It's over. It's finished. Matt's in pieces. Goodbye, Sarah."
Robin hung up, then read the text that had just arrived. "Meet me after work, or I'm giving a statement to the press." Eager as she was to return to the group next door and relay the sensational information she had just received, Robin remained where she stood, temporarily flummoxed by the threat, and texted back, "Statement to the press about what?" His response came within seconds, littered with angry typos. "The mail called the office this morning, G, and left a message asking how I feel about my dive shacking up with Cornish Strike. The Sun's been one this afternoon. You probably know he's two-timing you, but maybe you don't give a shit. I'm not having the papers calling me at work. Either meet me, or I'm go give a statement to get them off my back." Robin was rereading the message when yet another text arrived, this time with an attachment. "In case you haven't seen it." Robin enlarged the attachment, which was a screenshot of a diary item in the Evening Standard. "The Curious Case of Charlotte Campbell and Cormoran Strike. A staple of the gossip columns ever since she ran away from her first private school, Charlotte Campbell has lived out her life in a glare of publicity. Most people would choose a discreet spot for their consultation with a private detective. But the pregnant Ms. Campbell, now Mrs. Jago Ross, chose the window table of one of the West End's busiest restaurants. Were detective services under discussion during the intense heart-to-heart, or something more personal? The colourful Mr. Strike, illegitimate son of rock star Johnny Rokeby, war hero and modern-day Sherlock Holmes, also happens to be Campbell's ex-lover. Campbell's businessman husband will doubtless be keen to solve the mystery, business or pleasure, upon his return from New York. A mass of uncomfortable feelings jostled inside Robin, of which the dominant ones were panic, anger, and mortification at the thought of Matthew speaking to the press in such a way as to leave open, spitefully, the possibility that she and Strike were indeed sleeping together. She tried to call the number, but it went straight to voicemail. 2 seconds later, another angry text appeared. "I'm with a client. I don't want to talk about this in front of him. Just meet me." Angry now, Robin texted. "And I'm at New Scotland Yard. Find a quiet corner." She could imagine Matthew's polite smile as the client watched, his smooth, just the office excuse me, while he hammered out his furious replies. "We've got stuff to sort out and you're acting like a child refusing to meet me. Either you come to talk to me or I'm ringing the papers at 8. I notice you're not denying you're sleeping with him, by the way." Furious but feeling cornered, Robin typed back, "Fine, let's discuss it face to face. Where?" He texted her directions to a bar in Little Venice. Still shaken, Robin pushed open the door to the incident room. The group was now huddled around a monitor showing a page of Jimmy Knight's blog, from which Strike was reading aloud. "In other words, a single bottle of wine at Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons can cost more than a single out-of-work mother receives per week to feed, clothe, and house her entire family." "Now that," said Strike, "struck me as a weirdly specific choice of restaurant, if he wanted to rant about Tories and their spending. That's what made me think he'd been there recently. Then Robin tells me Blanc de Blanc is the name of one of their suites, but I didn't put that together as quickly as I should have done. It hit me a few hours later." "He's hell of a bloody hypocrite on top of everything else, isn't he?" said Wardle, who was standing, arms folded, behind Strike. "You've looked in Woolston?" Strike asked. "The shithole in Charlemont Road, Woolston everywhere," said Leybourne. "But don't worry. We've got a line on one of his girlfriends down in Dulwich. Checking there right now. With luck, we'll have him in custody tonight." Leybourne now noticed Robin, standing with her phone in her hand. "I know you've already got people looking at it," she told Leybourne, "but I've got a contact at Christie's. I sent her the picture of Mare Morning and she's just called me back. According to one of their experts, it might be a Stubbs."
"Even I've heard of Stubbs," Leybourne said.
"What would it be worth if it is?" Wardle asked.
"My contact thinks upwards of 22 million.
Wardle whistled. Leybourne said, "Fuck me."
"Doesn't matter to us what it's worth," Strike reminded them all. "What matters is whether somebody might have spotted its potential value."
22 fucking million, said Wardle, "is a hell of a motive."
"Cormoran," said Robin, picking a jacket off the back of the chair where she'd left it. "Could I have a quick word outside? I'm going to have to leave, sorry," she said to the others.
"Everything okay?" Strike asked, as they re-entered the corridor together and Robin had closed the door on the group of police.
"Yes," said Robin, and then, "Well, not really. Maybe," she said, handing him her phone. "You'd better just read this."
Frowning, Strike scrolled slowly through the interchange between Robin and Matthew, including the Evening Standard clip.
"You're going to meet him?"
"I've got to. This must be why Mitch Patterson's sniffing around. If Matthew fans the flames with the press, which he's more than capable of doing, they're already excited about you and..."
"Forget me and Charlotte," he said roughly. "That was 20 minutes that she coerced me into. He's trying to coerce you."
"I know he is," said Robin. "But I have got to talk to him sooner or later. Most of my stuff's still in Albury Street. We've still got a joint bank account."
"Do you want me to come?"
Touched, Robin said,
Thanks, but I don't think that would help.
Then ring me later, will you? Let me know what happened.
I will, she promised.
She headed off alone towards the lifts. She didn't even notice who had just walked past her in the opposite direction until somebody said, Bobby?
Robin turned.
There stood Flick Purdue, returning from the bathroom with a policewoman who seemed to have escorted her there. Like Kinvara, Flick had cried away her makeup. She appeared small and shrunken in a white shirt that Robin suspected her parents had insisted she wear rather than her Hezbollah T-shirt.
It's Robin. How are you, Flick?
Flick seemed to be struggling with ideas too monstrous to utter.
I hope you're cooperating, said Robin. Tell them everything, won't you?
She thought she saw a tiny shake of the head, an instinctive defiance, the last embers of loyalty not yet extinguished, even in the trouble Flick found herself.
You must, said Robin quietly. He'd have killed you next, Flick. You knew too much.
Chapter 69 I have foreseen all contingencies long ago. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. A 20-minute tube ride later, Robin emerged at Warwick Avenue Underground Station, in a part of London she barely knew. She had always felt a vague curiosity about Little Venice, as her extravagant middle name, Venetia, had been given to her because she had been conceived in the real Venice. Doubtless she would henceforth associate this area with Matthew and the bitter, tense meeting she was sure awaited her down by the canal. She walked down a street named Clifton Villas, where plane trees spread leaves of translucent jade against square cream-coloured houses, the walls of which glowed gold in the evening sun. The quiet beauty of this soft summer evening made Robin feel suddenly, overwhelmingly melancholy, because it recalled just such a night in Yorkshire, a decade previously, when she had hurried up the road from her parents' house, barely 17 years old, and wobbling on her high heels, desperately excited about her first date with Matthew Cunliffe, who had just passed his driving test and would be taking her into Harrogate for the evening. And here she was walking towards him again to arrange the permanent disentanglement of their lives. Robin despised herself for feeling sad, for remembering, when it was preferable to concentrate on his unfaithfulness and unkindness, the joyful shared experiences that had led to love. She turned left, crossed the street and walked on, now in the chilly shadow of the brick that bordered the right-hand side of Blomfield Road, parallel to the canal, and saw a police car speeding across the top of the street. The sight of it gave her strength. It felt like a friendly wave from what she knew now was her real life, sent to remind her what she was meant to be, and how incompatible that was with being the wife of Matthew Cunliffe. A pair of high black wooden gates was set into the wall, gates that Matthew's text had told her led to the canal side bar. But when Robin pushed at them, they were locked. She glanced up and down the road, but there was no sign of Matthew. So she reached into her bag for her mobile, which, though muted, was already vibrating with a call. As she took it out, the electric gates opened, and she walked through them, raising the mobile to her ear as she did so.
"Hi, I'm just..." Strike yelled in her ear. "Get out of there! It isn't Matthew!"
Several things happened at once. The phone was torn out of her hand. In one frozen second, Robin registered that there was no bar in sight, only an untidy patch of canal bank beneath a bridge, hemmed in by overgrown shrubs, and a dark barge, Odile, sitting squat and shabby in the water below her. Then a fist hit her hard in the solar plexus, and she jackknifed, winded. Doubled over, she heard a splash as her phone was lobbed into the canal. Then somebody grabbed a fistful of her hair and the waistband of her trousers and dragged her, while she still had no air in her lungs to scream, towards the barge. Thrown through the open doorway of the boat, she hit a narrow wooden table and fell to the floor. The door slammed shut. She heard the scrape of a lock.
"Sit down," said a male voice.
Still winded, Robin pulled herself up onto a wooden bench at the table, which was covered in a thin cushion pad, then turned to find herself looking into the barrel of a revolver. Raphael lowered himself into the chair opposite her.
"Who just rang you?" he demanded, and she deduced that in the physical effort to get her on the boat, and his terror that she might make a noise that the caller could hear, he had not had time or opportunity to check the screen on her mobile.
"My husband," lied Robin in a whisper.
Her scalp was burning where he had pulled her hair. The pain in her midriff was such that she wondered whether he had cracked one of her ribs. Still fighting to draw air into her lungs, Robin seemed for a few disorientated seconds to see her predicament in miniature, from far away, encased in a trembling bead of time. She foresaw Raphael tipping her weighted corpse into the dark water by night, and Matthew, who had apparently lured her to the canal, being questioned and maybe accused. She saw the distraught faces of her parents and her brothers at her funeral in Masham, and she saw Strike, standing at the back of the church, as he had at her wedding, furious because the things he had feared had come to pass, and she was dead due to her own failings. But as each gasp reinflated Robin's lungs, the illusion that she was watching from afar dissolved. She was here, now, on this dingy boat, breathing in its fusty smell, trapped within its wooden walls, with the dilated pupil of the revolver staring at her, and Raphael's eyes above it. Her fear was a real, solid presence in the galley, but it must stand apart from her, because it couldn't help and would only hinder. She must stay calm and concentrate. She chose not to speak. It would give her back some of the power he had just taken from her if she refused to fill the silence. This was the trick of the therapist. Let the pause unspool. Let the more vulnerable person fill it.
"You're very cool," Raphael said finally. "I thought you might get hysterical and scream. That's why I had to punch you. I wouldn't have done that otherwise. For what it's worth, I like you, Venetia."
She knew that he was trying to reimpersonate the man who had charmed her against her will at the Commons. Clearly, he thought the old mixture of ruefulness and remorse would make her forgive and soften, even with her burning scalp and her bruised ribs, and the gun in her face. She said nothing. His faint, imploring smile disappeared, and he said bluntly, "I need to know how much the police know. If I can still blag my way out of what they've got, then I'm afraid you..." He raised the gun a fraction, to point directly at Robin's forehead, and she thought of Vets and the one clean shot that the horse in the dell had been denied. "Are done for. I'll muffle the shot in a cushion and put you overboard once it's dark. But if they already know everything, then I'll end it here tonight, because I'm never going back to prison. So you can see how it's in your best interests to be honest, can't you? Only one of us is getting off this boat." And when she didn't speak, he said fiercely,
"Answer me!"
"Yes," she said. "I understand." "So," he said quietly, "were you really just at Scotland Yard?"
"Yes."
"Is Kimvara there?"
"Yes."
"Under arrest?"
"I think so. She's in an interrogation room with her solicitor."
"Why have they arrested her?"
"They think the two of you are having an affair. That you were behind everything."
"What's everything?"
"The blackmail," said Robin. "And the murder."
He advanced the gun so that it was pressing against her forehead. Robin felt the small, cold ring of metal pressing into her skin.
"Sounds like a crock of shit to me.
How are we supposed to have had an affair? She hated me. We were never alone together for 2 minutes."
"Yes, you were," said Robin.
"Your father invited you down to Chisel House right after you got out of jail, the night he was detained in London. You and she were alone together then. That's when we think it started."
"Proof?"
"None," said Robin. "But I think you could seduce anyone if you really put your..."
"Don't try flattery, it won't work. Seriously. That's when we think it started. Is that all you've got?"
"No. There were other signs of something going on."
Tell me the signs, all of them.
I'd be able to remember better, said Robin steadily, without you pressing a gun into my forehead.
He withdrew it, but still pointing the revolver at her face, he said, Go on, quickly.
Part of Robin wanted to succumb to her body's desire to dissolve, to carry her off into blissful unconsciousness. Her hands were numb, her muscles felt like soft wax. The place where Raphael had pressed the gun into her skin felt cold, a ring of white fire for a third eye. He hadn't turned on the lights in the boat. They were facing each other in the deepening darkness, and perhaps, by the time he shot her, she would no longer be able to see him clearly.
Focus, said a small, clear voice through the panic.
Focus. The longer you keep him talking, the more time they'll have to find you. Strike knows you were tricked.
She suddenly remembered the police car speeding across the top of Blomfield Road, and wondered whether it had been circling, looking for her. Whether the police, knowing that Raphael had lured her to the area, had already dispatched officers to search for them. The fake address had been some distance away along the canal bank, reached, so Raphael's text had said, through the black gates. Would Strike guess that Raphael was armed? She took a deep breath.
Kinvara broke down in Delawyn's office last summer and said that someone had told her she'd never been loved, that she was used as part of a game.
She must speak slowly. Don't rush it. Every second that she could keep Raphael hanging on her words was another second in which somebody might come to her aid.
Della assumed she was talking about your father, but we checked and Della can't remember Kinvara actually saying his name. We think you seduced Kinvara as an act of revenge towards your father, kept the affair going for a couple of months, but when she got clingy and possessive, you ditched her.
All supposition, said Raphael harshly, and therefore bullshit. What else?
Why did Kinvara go up to town on the day her beloved mare was likely to be put down?
Maybe she couldn't face seeing the horse shot. Maybe she was in denial about how sick it was.
Or, said Robin, maybe she was suspicious about what you and Francesca were up to in Drummond's gallery.
No proof. Next.
She had a kind of breakdown when she got back to Oxfordshire. She attacked your father and was hospitalized.
Still grieving her stillborn, excessively attached to her horses, generally depressed, Raphael rattled off. Izzy and Fizzy will fight to take the stand and explain how unstable she is. What else?
Tegan told us that one day Kinvara was manically happy again, and she lied when asked why. She said your father had agreed to put her other mare in foal to Tatilus. We think the real reason was that you'd resume the affair with her, and we don't think the timing was coincidental. You'd just driven the latest batch of paintings up to Drummond's gallery for valuation.
Raphael's face became suddenly slack, as though his essential self had temporarily vacated it. The gun twitched in his hand, and the fine hairs on Robin's arms lifted gently, as though a breeze had rippled over them. She waited for Raphael to speak, but he didn't. After a minute, she continued,
We think that when you loaded up the paintings for valuation, you saw Mare Morning close up for the first time, and realized that it might be a Stubbs. You decided to substitute a different painting of a mare and foal for valuation.
Evidence?
Henry Drummond's now seen the photograph I took of Mare Morning on the spare bed at Chisel House. He's ready to testify that it wasn't among the pictures he valued for your father. The painting he valued at £5,000 to £8,000 was by John Frederick Herring, and it showed a black and white mare and foal. Drummond's also ready to testify that you're sufficiently knowledgeable about art to have spotted that Mare Morning might be a Stubbs. Raphael's face had lost its mask-like cast. Now his near-black irises swiveled fractionally from side to side, as though he were reading something only he could see.
I must have accidentally taken the Frederick Herring instead. A police siren sounded a few streets away. Raphael's head turned. The siren wailed for a few seconds, then, as abruptly as it had started, was shut off. He turned back to face Robin. He didn't seem overly worried by the siren now it had stopped. Of course, he thought that it had been Matthew on the phone when he grabbed her. "Yeah," he said, regaining the thread of his thought. "That's what I'll say. I took the painting of the piebald to be valued by mistake. Never saw Mare Morning. Had no idea it might be a Stubbs."
"You can't have taken the piebald picture by mistake," said Robin quietly. "It didn't come from Chisel House, and the family's prepared to say so."
"The family," said Raphael, "don't notice what's under their fucking noses. A Stubbs has been hanging in a damp spare bedroom for nigh on 20 years, and nobody noticed. And you know why? Because they're such fucking arrogant snobs. Mare Morning was old Tinky's. She inherited it from the broken-down, alcoholic, gaga old Irish baronet she married before my grandfather. She had no idea what it was worth. She kept it because it was horsey, and she loved horses. When her first husband died, she hopped over to England and pulled the same trick, became my grandfather's expensive private nurse, and then his even more expensive wife. She died intestate, and all her crap, it was mostly crap, got absorbed into the Chisel estate. The Frederick Herring could easily have been one of hers, and nobody noticed it, stuck away in some filthy corner of that bloody house.
What if the police traced the piebald picture?
They won't. It's my mother's. I'll destroy it. When the police ask me, I'll say my father told me he was going to flog it now he knew it was worth 8 grand. He must have sold it privately, officer.
Kinvara doesn't know the new story. She won't be able to back you up.
This is where her well-known instability and unhappiness with my father works in my favour. Izzy and Fizzy will line up to tell the world that she never paid much attention to what he was up to, because she didn't love him and was only in it for the money. Reasonable doubt is all I need.
What's going to happen when the police put it to Kinvara that you only restarted the affair because you realised she might be about to become fantastically wealthy?
Raphael let out a long, slow hiss.
"Well," he said quietly, "if they can make Kinvara believe that, I'm fucked, aren't I?"
But right now, Kinvara believes her Raffi loves her more than anything in the world, and she's going to take a lot of convincing that's not true, because her whole life's going to fall apart otherwise. I drilled it into her. If they don't know about the affair, they can't touch us. I virtually had her reciting it while I fucked her. And I warned her they'd try and turn us against each other if either one of us was suspected. I got her very well schooled, and I said, when in doubt, cry your eyes out. Tell them nobody ever tells you anything, and act bloody confused.
She's already told one silly lie to try and protect you.
And the police know about it, said Robin.
What lie?
About the necklace in the early hours of Sunday morning. Didn't she tell you?
Maybe she realised you'd be angry.
What did she say?
Strike told her he didn't buy the new explanation for you going down to Chisel House the morning your father died.
What do you mean he didn't buy it? Said Raphael. And Robin saw outraged vanity mingled with his panic.
I thought it was convincing, she assured him. Clever, to tell a story that you'd appear to give up only unwillingly. Everyone's always more disposed to believe something they believe they've uncovered for themselves.
Raphael raised the gun so that it was close to her forehead again, and even though the cold ring of metal had not yet touched her skin again, she felt it there.
What lie did Kinvara tell?
She claimed you came to tell her that your mother removed diamonds from the necklace and replaced them with fakes.
Raphael appeared horrified.
What the fuck did she say that for?
Because she'd had a shock, I suppose, finding Strike and me in the grounds when you were hiding upstairs.
Strike said he didn't believe the necklace story, so she panicked and made up a new version. The trouble is, this one's checkable.
The stupid cunt.
said Raphael quietly, but with a venom that made the back of Robin's neck prickle. That stupid, stupid cunt. Why didn't she just stick to our story?
And... No, wait, he said, with the air of a man suddenly making a welcome connection. And to Robin's mingled consternation and relief, he withdrew the gun from where it had been almost touching her, and laughed softly.
That's why she hid the necklace on Sunday afternoon. She gave me some fucking guff about not wanting Izzy or Fizzy to sneak in and take it. Well, she's stupid, but she's not hopeless. Unless someone checks the stones, we're still in the clear. And they'll have to take apart the stable block to find it. Okay, he said, as though talking to himself. Okay. I think all of that's recoverable.
Is that it, Venetia? Is that all you've got?
No, said Robin. There's Flick Purdue.
I don't know who that is.
Yes, you do. You picked her up months ago and fed her the truth about the gallows, knowing she'd pass the information to Jimmy.
What a busy boy I've been, said Raphael lightly. So what? Flick won't admit to shagging a Tory minister's son, especially if Jimmy might find out. She's as besotted with him as Kinvara is with me.
That's true. She didn't want to admit it, but somebody must have spotted you creeping out of her flat next morning. She tried to pretend you were an Indian waiter. Robin thought she saw a minute wince of surprise and displeasure. Raphael's amour prop was wounded at the thought that he could have been so described.
Okay, he said, after a moment or two.
Okay, let's see. What if it was a waiter Flick shagged, but she's maliciously claiming it was me because of her class warrior bullshit and the grudge her boyfriend's got against my family? You stole her flatmate's credit card out of a bag in the kitchen. She could tell by the tightening of his mouth that he had not expected this. Doubtless he had thought that given Flick's lifestyle, suspicion would fall on anyone passing through her tiny, overcrowded flat, and perhaps especially Jimmy.
Proof? He said again.
Flick can provide the date you were at her flat, and if Laura testifies her credit card went missing that night.
But with no firm evidence I was ever there.
How did Flick find out about the gallows?
We know she told Jimmy about them, not the other way round. Well, it can't have been me, can it? I'm the only member of the family who never knew.
You knew everything. Kinvara had the full story from your father, and she passed it all to you.
No, said Raphael. I think you'll find Flick heard about the gallows from the Butcher brothers. I'm reliably informed that one of them lives in London now. Yeah, I think I've heard a rumour one of them shagged their mate Jimmy's girlfriend. And believe me, the Butcher brothers aren't going to come over well in court, pair of shifty oiks driving gallows around under cover of darkness. I'm going to look a lot more plausible and presentable than Flick and the Butchers if this comes to court. I really am.
The police have got phone records, Robin persisted. They know about an anonymous call to Geraint Wynne, which was made around the time Flick found out about the gallows. We think you tipped off Wynne anonymously about Samuel Merapi. You knew Wynne had a grudge against the Chisels. Kinvara told you everything.
I don't know anything about that phone call, Your Honour, said Raphael. And I'm very sorry that my late brother was a prize cunt to Rhiannon Wynne, but that's nothing to do with me.
We think you made that threatening call to Izzy's office, the first day you were there, talking about people pissing themselves as they die, said Robin. And we think it was your idea for Kinvara to pretend she kept hearing intruders in the grounds. Everything was designed to create as many witnesses as possible to the fact that your father had reason to be anxious and paranoid that he might crack under extreme pressure.
He was under extreme pressure. He was being blackmailed by Jimmy Knight. Geraint Wynne was trying to force him out of his job. Those aren't lies, they're facts. And they're going to be pretty sensational in a courtroom, especially once the Samuel Merapi story gets out.
Except that you made stupid, avoidable mistakes.
He sat up straighter and leaned forwards, his elbows sliding a few inches so that the nozzle of the gun grew larger. His eyes
which had been smudges in the shadow, became clearly defined again, onyx black and white. Robin wondered how she had ever thought him handsome.
What mistakes?
As he said it, Robin saw out of the corner of her eye a flashing blue light glide over the bridge, just visible through the window to her right, which was blocked from Raphael's view by the side of the boat. The light vanished, and the bridge was reabsorbed by the deepening darkness.
"For one thing," said Robin carefully, "it was a mistake to keep meeting Kinvara in the lead-up to the murder. She kept pretending she'd forgotten where she was meeting your father, didn't she? Just to get a couple of minutes with you, just to see you and check up on you. That's not proof."
Kinvara was followed to Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons on her birthday.
His eyes narrowed. "Who by?"
"Jimmy Knight. Flicks confirmed it. Jimmy thought your father was with Kinvara and wanted to confront him publicly about not giving him his money. Obviously, your father wasn't there. So Jimmy went home and wrote an angry blog about how high Tories spend their money, mentioning Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons by name.
Well, unless he saw me sneaking into Kinvara's hotel suite," said Raphael, "which he didn't, because I took fucking good care to make sure nobody did. That's all supposition, too."
"All right," said Robin. "What about the second time you were overheard having sex in the gallery bathroom?"
"That wasn't Francesca.
You were with Kinvara."
"Prove it."
"Kinvara was in town that day buying Lachesis pills and pretending she was angry that your father was still seeing you, which was all part of the cover story that she hated you. She rang your father to check that he was having lunch elsewhere. Strike overheard the call. What you and Kinvara didn't realize was that your father was having lunch only 100 yards away from where you were having sex. When your father forced his way into the bathroom, he found a tube of Lachesis pills on the floor. That's why he nearly had a heart attack. He knew that's what she'd come to town for. He knew who'd just been having sex with you in the bathroom."
Raphael's smile was more of a grimace. "Yeah, that was a fuck-up. The day he came into our office talking about Lachesis, knows when everyone's number's up. I realized later he was trying to put the frighteners on me, wasn't he? I didn't know what the hell he was on about at the time. But when you and your crippled boss mentioned the pills at Chisel House, Kinvara twigged. They fell out of her pocket while we were screwing. We hadn't known what first tipped him off. It was only after I heard he was ringing Le Manoir about Freddy's money clip that I knew he must have realized something was going on. Then he invited me over to Ebury Street, and I knew he was about to confront me about it, and we needed to get a move on, killing him." The entirely matter-of-fact way he discussed patricide chilled Robin. He might have been talking about wallpapering a room. He must have been planning to produce those pills during his big "I know you're fucking my wife" speech. Why didn't I spot them on the floor? I tried to put the room straight afterwards, but they must have rolled out of his pocket or something. "It's harder than you think," said Raphael, "tidying up around a corpse you've just dispatched. I was surprised, actually, how much it affected me." She had never heard his narcissism so clearly. His interest and sympathy was entirely for himself. His dead father was nothing. "The police have taken statements from Francesca and her parents now," said Robin. "She absolutely denies being in the bathroom with you that second time. Her parents never believed her, but they didn't believe her because she's even fucking dumber than Kinvara. The police are combing through security camera footage from the shops she says she was in while you and Kinvara were in the bathroom." "Okay," said Raphael.
"Well, worst comes to the worst, and they can prove she wasn't with me. I might have to come clean about the fact that it was another young lady I was with in the bathroom that day, whose reputation I've been chivalrously trying to defend."
"Will you really be able to find a woman to lie for you in court on a murder charge?" asked Robin, in disbelief.
"The woman who owns this houseboat is mad for me," said Raphael softly. "We had a thing going before I went inside. She visited me in jail and everything. She's in rehab right now. Crazy bitch, loves drama, thinks she's an artist.
She drinks too much. She's a real pain in the arse, actually, but she fucks like a rabbit. She never bothered taking the spare key to this place off me, and she keeps a key to her mummy's house in that drawer over there. It wouldn't happen to be her mother's house where you had the helium tubing and gloves delivered, would it? Asked Robin. Raphael blinked. He hadn't expected that. You needed an address that didn't seem connected to you. You made sure it was delivered while the owners were away or at work. Then you could let yourself in, collect the failed delivery card, pick it up, disguised, and get it couriered off to dear old Dad's house, yeah. And Flick took delivery, and Kinvara made sure she hid it from your father until it was time to kill him. That's right, said Raphael. You pick up a lot of tips in jail. Fake IDs, vacant buildings, empty addresses. You can do a hell of a lot with them. Once you're dead, Robin's scalp prickled, nobody's going to connect me with any of the addresses. The owner of this barge is going to be telling everyone she was having sex with me in Drummond's bathroom, remember? She's on my team, Venetia, he said quietly. So it's not looking good for you, is it? There were other mistakes, said Robin, her mouth dry. Like? You told Flick your father needed a cleaner. Yeah, because it makes her and Jimmy look fishy as hell, as she wheedled her way into my father's house. The jury'll be focused on that, not how she found out he wanted a cleaner. I've already told you, she's going to look like a grubby little tart with a grudge in the dock. That's just one more lie. But she stole a note from your father. A note he wrote while he was trying to check Kinvara's story with Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons. I found it in her bathroom. She'd lied, told him her mother was going to the hotel with her. They'd never normally give out information about guests, but he was a government minister, and he'd previously been there, so we think he managed to trick them into agreeing that they could remember the family vehicle there, and that it was a shame her mother hadn't made it. He made a note of the suite Kinvara was in, probably pretending he'd forgotten it, and he was trying to get hold of the bill to see whether there was any sign of two lots of breakfast or dinner, I suppose. When the prosecution produced the note and the bill in court. You found that note, did you? Said Raphael. Robin's stomach turned over. She had not meant to give Raphael another reason to shoot her. I knew I'd underestimated you after that dinner we had at Nam Long Le Shaker, said Raphael. It wasn't a compliment. His eyes were narrowed, his nostrils flared in dislike. You were a mess, but you were still asking fucking inconvenient questions. You and your boss were cozier with the police than I expected, too. And even after I tipped off the mail, that was you, said Robin, wondering how she had never realized. You put the press and Mitch Patterson back on us. I told them you'd left your husband for strike, but that he was still shagging his ex. Izzy had given me that bit of gossip. I thought you needed slowing down, you two, because you kept poking away at my alibi. But after I've shot you... An icy chill ran the length of Robin's body. Your boss'll be busy answering the press's questions about how your body ended up in a canal, won't he? I think that's called killing two birds with one stone. Even if I'm dead, said Robin, her voice as steady as she could make it, there'll still be your father's note and the hotel's testimony. Okay, so he was worried about what Kinvara was doing at Le Manoir, said Raphael roughly. I've just told you, nobody saw me on the premises. The stupid cow did ask for two glasses with the champagne, but she could have been with someone else. You aren't going to have any opportunity to cook up a new story with her, said Robin, her mouth drier than ever, her tongue sticking to the roof of her mouth as she tried to sound calm and confident. She's in custody now. She isn't as clever as you. And you made other mistakes, Robin rushed on, stupid ones, because you had to enact the plan in a hurry once you realized your father was onto you. Like? Like Kinvara taking away the packaging on the amitriptyline, after she doctored the orange juice. Kinvara forgetting to tell you the trick to closing the front door properly. And, said Robin, aware that she was playing her very last card, her throwing the front door key to you at Paddington.
In the wordless space that now stretched between them, Robin thought she could hear footsteps close at hand. She didn't dare look out of the window in case she alerted Raphael, who appeared too appalled by what she had just said to take in anything else.
"Throwing the front door key to me," repeated Raphael, with fragile bravado. "What the hell are you talking about?"
"The keys to Ebury Street are restricted, almost impossible to copy. The pair of you only had access to one, hers, because your father was suspicious of you both by the time he died, and he'd made sure the spare was out of your reach. She needed the key to get into the house and doctor the orange juice, and you needed it to go in early next morning and suffocate him. So you cobbled together a plan at the last minute. She'd pass you the key at a prearranged spot at Paddington, where you'd be disguised as a homeless person. You were caught on camera. The police have got people enlarging and clarifying the image right now. They think you must have bought things from a charity shop in haste, which might produce another useful witness. The police are now combing CCTV footage for your movements from Paddington onwards." Raphael had said nothing at all for nearly a minute. His eyes were moving fractionally from left to right as he tried to find a loophole, an escape.
"That's inconvenient," he said finally. "I didn't think I was on camera sitting there."
Robin thought she could see hope slipping away from him now. Quietly, she continued, "As per your plan, Kinvara arrived home in Oxfordshire, called Drummond, and left a message that she wanted the necklace valued to set up that whole backup story. Early next morning, another burner phone was used to call both Geraint Wynne and Jimmy Knight. Both were lured out of their houses, presumably with a promise of information on Chisel. That was you, making sure they were in the frame if murder was suspected."
"No proof," muttered Raphael automatically. But still his eyes darted this way and that, searching for invisible lifelines.
"You let yourself into the house very early in the morning, expecting to find your father almost comatose after his early morning orange juice, but—"
"He was out of it at first," said Raphael.
His eyes had become glazed, and Robin knew that he was remembering what happened, watching it, inside his head. "He was slumped on the sofa, very groggy. I walked straight past him into the kitchen, opened my box of toys." For a sliver of a second, Robin saw again the shrink-wrapped head, the grey hair pressed around the face so that only the gaping black hole of the mouth was visible. Raphael had done that. Raphael, who currently had a gun pointing at her face.
"But while I'm arranging everything, the old bastard wakes up, sees me fixing the tubing onto the helium canister, and comes back to fucking life. He staggers up, grabs Freddy's sword off the wall and tries to fight. But I got it off him. Bent the blade doing it. Forced him down into the chair. He was still struggling and—"
Raphael mimed putting the bag over his father's head.
"Caput."
"And then," said Robin, her mouth still dry, "you made those phone calls from his phone that were supposed to establish your alibi. Kinvara had told you his passcode, of course, and you left, without closing the door properly." Robin didn't know whether she was imagining movement out of the porthole to her left. She kept her eyes fixed on Raphael and a slightly wavering gun.
"Loads of this is circumstantial," he muttered, eyes still glazed. "Flick and Francesca have both got motives for lying about me. I didn't end it well with Francesca. I might still have a chance. I might—"
"There's no chance, Raph," said Robin. "Kinvara isn't going to lie for you much longer. When they tell her the truth about Mare Morning, she's going to put everything together for the first time. I think you insisted she move it into the drawing room to protect it from the damp in the spare room. How did you manage that? Did you make up some rubbish about it reminding you of her dead mare? Then she's going to realize you started up the affair again once you knew its true value, and that all the dreadful things you said to her when you ended it were true. And worst of all," said Robin, "she's going to realize that when the two of you heard intruders in the grounds, real ones,
this time. You let the woman you were supposedly madly in love with walk out into the grounds in the dark, in her nightdress, while you stayed behind to protect—
All right!
He shouted suddenly, and he advanced the gun nozzle until it pressed into her forehead again.
Stop fucking talking, will you?
Robin sat quite still. She imagined how it would feel when he pressed the trigger. He had said he would shoot her through a cushion to muffle the sound, but perhaps he had forgotten. Perhaps he was about to lose control.
Do you know what it's like in jail?
He asked. She tried to say no, but the sound wouldn't come.
The noise, he whispered. The smell. The ugly, dumb people, like animals, some of them. Worse than animals. I never knew there were people like it. The places they make you eat and shit. Watching your back all the time, waiting for violence. The clanging, the yelling, and the fucking squalor. I'd rather be buried alive. I won't do it again.
I was going to have a dream life. I was going to be free, totally free. I'd never have to kowtow to the likes of fucking Drummond again. There's a villa on Capri I've had my eye on for a long time. View out over the Gulf of Naples. Then I'd have a nice pad in London. New car, once my fucking ban's lifted. Imagine walking along and knowing you could buy anything, do anything. A dream life. Couple of little problems to get out of the way before I was completely sorted. Flick, easy. Late night, dark road, knife in the ribs. Victim of street crime. And Kinvara. Once she'd made a will in my favour, after a few years she'd have broken her neck riding an unsuitable horse or drowned out in Italy. She's a terrible swimmer. And then all of them could fuck themselves, couldn't they? The Chisels, my whore of a mother. I'd need nothing from anyone. I'd have everything. But that's all gone, he said. Dark-skinned though he was, she saw that he had turned ashen, the dark shadows beneath his eyes hollow in the half-light. It's all gone. You know what, Venetia? I'm going to blow your fucking brains out, because I've decided I don't like you. I think I'd like to see your fucking head explode before mine comes off.
Raff!
Raff! Raff! He bleated, imitating her. Why do all women think they're different? You're not different. None of you. He was reaching for the limp cushion beside him. We'll go together. I'd like to arrive in hell with a sexy girl on my arse. With a great splintering of wood, the door crashed open. Raphael spun around, pointing the gun at the large figure that had just fallen inside. Robin launched herself over the table to grab his arm, but Raphael knocked her backwards with his elbow, and she felt blood spurt as her lip split.
Raph! No! Don't!
He had stood up, stooped in the cramped space, the barrel of the gun in his mouth. Strike, who had shouldered in the door, stood panting feet away from him, and behind Strike was Wardle.
Go on and do it then, you cowardly little fuck, said Strike.
Robin wanted to protest, but couldn't make a noise. There was a small metallic click.
Took out the bullets at Chisel House, you stupid bastard, said Strike,
hobbling forwards and smacking the revolver out of Raphael's mouth.
Not half as clever as you thought you were, eh?
There was a great ringing in Robin's ears. Raphael was spitting oaths in English and Italian, screaming threats, thrashing and twisting, as Strike helped bend him over the table for Wardle to cuff him. But she stumbled away from the group as though in a dream, backwards towards the kitchen area of the galley, where pots and pans were hanging, and white kitchen roll sat, ludicrously ordinary, beside a tiny sink. She could feel her lip swelling where Raphael had hit her. She tore off some kitchen roll, ran it under the cold tap, and pressed it to her bleeding mouth, while through the porthole she watched uniformed officers hurrying through the black gates, taking possession of the gun and of the struggling Raphael, whom Wardle had just dragged onto the bank. She had just been held at gunpoint. Nothing seemed real. Now the police were stomping in and out of the barge, but it was all noise and echo,
and now she realized that Strike was standing beside her, and he seemed the only person with any reality.
How did you know?